Justice Powell. We'll hear arguments first this morning in United States against Mendenhall. Mr. Fry, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case is here on writ of certiorari to review a judgment of the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, reversing respondent's conviction for possession of heroin on the ground that the heroin in question had been discovered as a result of an illegal search. The case began when two trained DEA agents assigned to the Detroit airport observed respondent deplane from an early morning flight from Los Angeles, which they knew to be a major source city for heroin. The agents became suspicious when she exhibited unusual nervousness and scanned the terminal area as though looking for surveillance. After following her through the airport and having their suspicions reinforced, they approached her as she was proceeding down a concourse toward the gate for an Eastern Airlines flight to Pittsburgh, identified themselves as federal agents, and asked if she would show them some identification and her ticket. She did so, and they discovered that she was traveling under an assumed name. After several more questions, they asked if she would accompany them to the nearby DEA office for further questioning, which she did. Once inside the office, the agents asked respondent if she would consent to a search of her pocketbook and of her person, informing her that she had a right to refuse consent to the search. She consented, and the ensuing search disclosed over half a pound of heroin. The entire encounter took about 10 minutes. District Court found that the agents had a reasonable...
You mean preceding the search?
The initial encounter in the airport concourse took about 2 or 3 minutes, and then the further events in the DEA office took another 5 to 10 minutes.
Including the search?
I believe that's what the evidence was. In any event, until up to the point where the consent was given to the search was a relatively brief period of only a few minutes. Now, the district court found that the agents had a reasonable suspicion that respondent was engaged in criminal activities at the time they first approached her, that she went to the office with the agents voluntarily in a spirit of apparent cooperation, and that she thereafter voluntarily consented to the search.
Mr. Fry, do you think that when you say there was a reasonable suspicion from the outset, are you talking in Terry terms? Or not?
The district court, I think, was talking in Terry terms.
Well, how about you?
I intend to devote most of my argument to the question of whether this was a Terry stop, and if so, whether the quantum of
so your answer is
suspicion
yes.
was sufficient.
Yes. At the moment, you're just telling us what the district court held.
I'm telling you what the district court held. That's correct. I think ultimately my answer is probably no, that the standard is not the same as Terry, but rather the lesser standard that
so you don't think you don't
stop the
lesser. you don't think that at the time they first spoke to her that they had a right to pat her down?
No, I don't think they had a right to pat her down or frisk her, but that relates to the reasonable perception that she might be dangerous, which I don't think they had.
But it also depends on whether there's a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity.
It does, and I do think they had a right to detain her at the time they first spoke to her. That is, to stop her. I'm not asserting that they had a right to frisk her, and they didn't frisk her.
You're depending on...
Terry, you rely on the MIM standard, are you?
No, I intend to rely on Martinez Fuerte for that proposition, because in Martinez Fuerte, as I will get to, the court suggested that the quantum of suspicion that was needed for a roving patrol stop in Brignone Ponce was not necessary for a referral to a secondary inspection area for questioning in Martinez Fuerte. And I think, while I think they had enough suspicion to meet the normal Brignone Ponce standard in this case, I think the minimal nature of the intrusion required even less suspicion than that.
In other words, there's a standard below Terry that you rely on for that.
Well, it's difficult to say whether Terry enunciated a standard on the facts of Terry and held that what was known to the officer justified the action that he took in Terry. I think that the court's ensuing cases have made clear that the inquiry is a measurement of the degree of intrusion involved in the particular police action weighed against the degree of suspicion, the basis for the officer's action, and the law enforcement need.
You are taking the position, I don't want to take too much of your time, you are taking the position that something less than Terry can, in some circumstance, justify a detention against the will of the person detained.
Well, I am saying that the kind of encounter that occurred in the airport between the agents and Respondent Mendenhall, which we first contend was not a seizure of her person at all.
I understand.
If the court disagrees with that contention and holds that it is a seizure, I am contending next that some suspicion that might not justify a stop of an automobile or a frisk would justify going up to somebody and asking them questions, as was done here. And I'm further contending that even if the court disagrees with that, that what existed here was enough for a Terry stop.
I understand that.
Mr. Fry, you've been here often enough so that you'll understand this question may be repetitious. It's my understanding that your first contention is that a simple approach by a police officer to someone and say, I'd like to ask you a question, is not a detention at all.
Not a seizure of the person.
Not a seizure of the
Fourth Amendment.
The Fourth Amendment.
That is our first contention.
Are you depending, move now into the drug office, are you depending on her consent to a search?
We are making two alternative arguments, either of which would justify reversal of the Court of Appeals decision. The first, that it was supported by her consent and therefore did not have to meet other Fourth Amendment requirements. And the second, that it did satisfy the requirements of the Fourth Amendment, assuming the consent was not sufficient.
Why do you need the second one if you had the first one?
Well, I'm not sure that you'll agree with the first one, and therefore...
What you really want to do is extend it a little, don't you?
I'm not sure I understand.
You want to extend it beyond consent.
No.
Somebody else who doesn't consent will be forcibly held.
No,
is that what you want us to do?
I believe that what you would do logically would be to first...
Why do we have to do the second?
You don't have to reach the second issue if you agree with us on the first with regard to the move to the office. The district court sustained the move to the office on the ground of respondent's consent to go to the office. If that finding is not clearly erroneous...
You were telling us what the district court
That's
did,
where I was,
And
yes.
You were halfway through that, and you haven't even gotten to the Court of Appeals yet.
Correct. I'm not sure I've answered Justice Marshall's question, but...
It doesn't matter to me.
We are not insisting that you reach the second issue about whether this would be permissible in the absence of her consent, but if you find that there was not a valid consent, then we do present that second issue for your decision. Now, the Court of Appeals reversed... And in essence, the court held that the factors relied on to justify the initial encounter with respondent did not give rise to a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity because respondent's actions, as observed by the agents, were consistent with innocent behavior. It further held that asking respondent to accompany the agents to the DEA office constituted an arrest requiring probable cause on the ground that respondent was not free to leave at the time this occurred. Finally, the court held that the consent to the search was not valid. Presented for decision by this court are three questions, each of which has two sub-issues. First question concerns the initial encounter between the agents and respondent and whether that violated her Fourth Amendment rights. And as I've mentioned, we contend that it did not for two reasons. First, we contend that it was not a seizure of her person within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. Second, we contend that if it was supported by the necessary degree of suspicion to justify the particular minimally intrusive encounter.
And the facts were she was the last off the airplane, and then she went to the American Airlines counter.
I can get into that in some detail if you'd like. The facts on which the agents relied were first that she came from Los Angeles, which they were watching the flight from Los Angeles because it was known by them to be a source city of Mexican heroin. When she got off the plane, she got off last, but I think that is a subcategory of the fact that she looked around as though looking for surveillance and seemed unusually nervous. And that, I think it's quite clear, is what triggered the agent's suspicion of her. And indeed, I will argue that that in itself, because of the nature of the agent's experience, would be sufficient to justify what the agents thereafter did. They, in fact, followed her as she went down to the baggage area, didn't pick up any baggage.
Well, her baggage was checked through to Pittsburgh, wasn't it?
Well, we don't know whether she had any baggage or not. There's no...
If any, I mean, she was on
I understand
route to
that,
Pittsburgh.
But I'm telling you what occurred, and the agent had no idea at that point whether she was getting off at Detroit or making a connection someplace else. So as he described it in his testimony, initially he followed her down to the baggage area. She didn't pick up any baggage. That would have been suspicious if she was getting off at Detroit. She then went back upstairs to the Eastern Airlines counter and appeared to the agent, asked the ticket agent at the Eastern counter for a ticket on an Eastern flight to Pittsburgh. It appeared to the agent that she was changing her flight from some other carrier to Eastern.
Well, American doesn't fly between.
The record clearly show that as to what carrier she was booked on as far as
the record, the record does not clearly show what carrier. The record shows that it was he testified that it was an American Airlines ticket, which I
Well, that's the issuing carrier. But American Airlines doesn't fly from Detroit to Pittsburgh.
Well, you say that, and I accept that as true, but I'm not sure what the significance of that is in terms of — the question is not whether the agent was right that she had originally been booked on American Airlines to Pittsburgh. We simply don't know whether
she — was an agent at that airport, wasn't he?
Well, that's true, but,
one
the public
would presume
defender
that he might know where the various airlines went to.
Well, I'm not sure that that's a fair question to presume. I think that's a subject that should have been explored on cross-examination. In any event, there's nothing in the record to suggest whether or not she was changing from some other carrier to Eastern. The testimony is I stood in line directly behind her. She retrieved an airline ticket from her purse, presented that to the Eastern ticket agent, and asked for a ticket, an Eastern ticket, to be used on her flight from Detroit to Pittsburgh. Now, I don't think our case is dependent on the ultimate accuracy of his observation.
Then what happened? She still hadn't been directly approached by the Herbers.
She hadn't. And then the ticket agent gave her a boarding pass for the Eastern flight. She started down the concourse, and at that point the agents came up to her and said, "We're federal agents. Would you please show us your identification?"
And that was the first time there was a direct
That was the first contact
communication with her.
That's correct.
And down as she was going down the
concourse
toward the gate,
toward
the Eastern
gate.
Plane to Pittsburgh.
That is correct. In any event, in terms of my statement of the issues that are presented before I get into the discussion of the issues, the second issue is the validity of the transfer of the situs of the interview or encounter from the airport concourse to the DEA terminal office, rather. And as I suggested, we have two arguments there, one that it was supported by her voluntary consent, and the second that it was in any event a reasonable and limited extension of a Terry stop. By the way, at the point they went to the airport office, there is no question, I don't think it's disputed, that they had at least Terry-type reasonable suspicion because
reasonable suspicion that she was armed?
No.
That's what Terry has to do with.
Let us say Brignone-Ponce reasonable suspicion. Whatever the constitutional, however high the court chooses to set the constitutional floor for a stop based on reasonable suspicion, less than probable cause, a seizure of the person, not a frisk, but a seizure of the person, a detention. This case satisfied it once the agents talked to her and found out she was traveling under an alias, because we are now close to, if not over, the line of probable cause, and I'm sure that constitutes sufficient reasonable suspicion in anybody's book to justify the stop. And I don't understand the Court of Appeals to have said that there was not reasonable suspicion at that point. And I just wanted to make it clear that when they moved to the office, we have now shifted our debate to whether they needed probable cause to justify that movement. And that's what the Court of Appeals held, that probable cause was necessary to support.
Well, what did the Court of Appeals do with Judge DiMascio's finding that before the actual search was made, there was probable cause? As I read the Court of Appeals' opinion, it did nothing with it.
Well, I think it's plain that they disagreed with it. The opinion is rather succinct and
cryptic is the word I would use.
Well, perhaps. And it's difficult to tell, but I think one can only conclude that they did not agree with his finding that there was probable cause, and that, I think, essentially is not something we have contended here, because in our view it is not, probable cause is not necessary for what occurred.
Do you have a view on whether there was probable cause?
At the time of the search, I think it is quite arguable, because at the time of the search of her person, which disclosed the heroin, they not only knew that she had been traveling under one alias coming back from Los Angeles, but that she had traveled on yet a different alias and gone on yet a different carrier going out from Pittsburgh to Los Angeles. Which I would suppose is consistent with an evasive pattern that drug couriers exhibit.
Sort of like your answer. I don't know what your view is on whether there was probable cause or not.
Well, I haven't really thought about it in the course of preparing the argument. Well,
have you thought whether the search was justified without consent?
If there was probable cause? That is the same question, isn't it? If there was probable cause.
No, it isn't. Consent, probable cause to search. Search okay?
The search would be okay if the detention at that point was not a fruit of a prior Fourth Amendment violation, in which case there would be a separate
issue. What was the emergency?
What was the emergency in terms of searching her person?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they would have probable cause to arrest her, presumably, if if they had probable cause to search her, and the search could be made incident to an arrest.
Well, they never arrested her, did they?
Well, I'm not sure that would be necessary to sustain the search.
So you say you just don't ever reach any of those questions because you don't care to have to decide the probable
cause. We don't ask you to decide whether this was supportable as a probable cause search. We rely on her consent, which the district court found to be voluntary and which I don't believe the Court of Appeals questioned the voluntariness of. And if she was legally detained at the time she consented, then I think there is no basis for striking down the search. If she was illegally detained, then that raises the issue of whether the taint of the illegal detention was attenuated by
consent was voluntary. It might be a product of an illegal detention.
It might be. Indeed, under the Court of Appeals view, I think it's fair to say that that you could not give a voluntary, valid consent when you're in illegal detention. Our view, of course, is that you can, and that particularly where you're advised of your right to refuse consent, that attenuates the taint.
Your view really is that there was no detention at all, isn't it?
Our view is that there was no detention at the initial encounter.
Well, even in the office, was there detention?
Well, I've thought about that, and I'm not sure what the answer is. I don't think it's necessary to our success in this case at all be held that there was no detention by the time she reached the office.
Detention implies that being held against somebody's will, and if she went voluntarily along with the office and and voluntarily consented to the search and so on. There was no detention.
Yes, I think that would be our position.
Dictionary meaning of that word.
Although that then raises the question, which I am not planning to get into, of their subjective intention to detain her as she attempted to leave.
Did the agent testify that if she attempted to leave, he'd have stopped her?
Once he did testify, are you talking about when she was had consented to search?
What
when
you're
she
talking
was,
about right now. You're talking about in the corridor, weren't you?
Well, in the corridor, the testimony is quite ambiguous as to the point at which he would have stopped her had she attempted to leave.
Did he say that?
I think it's clear from the testimony that once he found out she was traveling under an alias, he would have stopped her had she attempted to leave. But our position, and it's arguable, I have to say that...
This is a well-trained witness, isn't it? And he's an intelligent, experienced agent.
Can I take
what he says as being a fact and true?
I take it as a fact that he would have stopped her once he found out she was traveling under an alias had she tried to leave.
Well, what exactly did he testify to?
Well, the testimony was, the particular testimony that we are adverting to now was given on cross-examination in response to what seems to me a somewhat ambiguous question. He's describing that, this is at page 18 and 19 of the appendix, and he says they looked at her license and they had reason to believe that she was Sylvia Mendenhall. And then the question is, had she put that identification in her purse and walked away from you, you would have stopped her, wouldn't you, because you wanted to ask her some more questions? And he says, yes. Now, I'm not quite clear because it's never clarified.
Well, couldn't the U.S. attorney in redirect straighten that out?
Yes, of course. I don't. Our position is that what he would have done is not material. It's only what he did do that counts. But you're right that the uncertainty as to whether — I do not think it is clear from this record that he intended to forcibly detain her from the very first moment he approached her. I don't think that is at all clear from the record.
Well, Mr. Fry, in the office, when the officer advised her that she need not consent to the search, he did
advise her that, yes.
I suppose that's either directly or indirectly an assertion an opinion that he didn't have probable cause to arrest.
No, not at all. Not at all. Since I think the normal practice and the proper practice is to seek consent even if you do believe you have probable cause.
I know, but if you arrest, you don't have any right to refuse the search.
Well, but you could tell somebody they have a right to refuse the search in an effort to ensure that you've secured a voluntary consent, even though if they say, I refuse, you could then say, well, I've decided that I'm going to arrest you and search you.
Oh, so all you said, all his advice was that if you don't want to be searched, I won't search you. Is that all
he was saying?
I thought
he was saying you have a right to withhold your consent.
I thought you were saying that he was telling her she had the right to refuse. The legal right to refuse.
Exactly. Yes. He was telling her
that she had the legal right to refuse.
Yes. And we don't know if she had said, no, I refuse, what would have happened.
Well, conceivably, one alternative would be, then sit down, young lady, until we get a warrant.
If the officer thought he had probable cause to search her, he might very well then have sought a warrant in order to do it. But since he obtained her consent, the question never arose as to what he should do if she didn't consent.
Mr. Fry, do I misunderstand the record? I was under the impression he obtained her consent before they went to the office.
There are two different findings of consent by the district court. The first is that she consented in a spirit of apparent cooperation and voluntarily to go from the terminal to the nearby office. And the second is a finding that once in the office and asked for a consent to the search, she voluntarily consented to be
is
searched.
Is there evidence in the record that she was asked for an additional consent in the office?
Yes, absolutely.
Is there?
I missed it. It's quite clear, and in fact, he is asked to recite in specific words the words that he used. Now, let me turn briefly to the question of whether what happened here was a seizure. The position of respondent and of the ACLU essentially is that when a police officer approaches someone who he finds suspicious and asks that person questions, that ought to be presumptively a seizure in the absence of a statement to the individual that they have a right to leave. Now, as Terry makes clear, a seizure is an actual restraint upon the individual's freedom to walk away. Accordingly, we agree with Professor Lefebvre's analysis of the problem, which and we quote from him in our brief, that this kind of encounter is only properly deemed a seizure if the officer is engaged in some additional conduct beyond the approach and the inquiry, whether by action or by statement, that would indicate to the individual that his freedom of movement has been curtailed. Now, the court has not squarely decided this issue, but we do think that Terry indicates the court's view on it, and I refer to footnote 16 in Terry, where the court, in talking about whether the initial contact between the officer and Terry, at which he walked up to him and asked him for identification, was a seizure, saying that it didn't have to, wasn't going to decide that, the court said, obviously not all personal intercourse between policemen and citizens involves seizures of persons. Only when the officer, by means of physical force or show of authority, has in some way restrained the liberty of a citizen, may we conclude that a seizure has occurred. We cannot tell with any certainty upon this record whether any such seizure took place here prior to Officer McFadden's initiation of physical contact for the purpose of searching Terry for weapons. Now, of course, if the view of respondent were correct, they could have told perfectly well that there had been a seizure.
Well,
because
Mr. Fry, I take it your basic position is that an officer could just at random pick out somebody in an airport and do exactly and the same events that happened here transpired, and you would say there was no violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Well, I think that is. Yes. That is our position, that there would not be a seizure, but I do.
And no violation of the Fourth Amendment in any of these, as a result of any of these.
If we're talking
events,
only about walking up to somebody and asking them a couple of questions or asking for identification.
And then asking them into the office?
If they consent.
Which you say they did.
Which I say.
And then the search, which you say there was consent to.
Well, that would clearly be a search.
Well,
at that
yes,
point,
but it was consent to.
I understand that would be a search,
so
that would be valid under the Fourth Amendment.
Any citizen would have no, if these same things happened to any citizen, there would be no violation.
Well, I think there is a difference, because the difference is that when you come to the search, you are talking about an action which is, in fact, governed by the Fourth Amendment.
Well, yes,
when
but you say there was consent.
That's right.
I say it's lawful. Yes, it's consistent with the Fourth Amendment.
Well, all I said was that your position is it does not violate the Fourth Amendment.
Well, I think there's a difference between saying that a particular incident does not implicate the Fourth Amendment and saying that an incident does not violate the Fourth Amendment. And in the one case, I say it's not implicated, and the other not violated.
But in any event, the answer to my question is any citizen picked out at random would not have had his Fourth Amendment rights violated by these events.
Had he agreed to cooperate right down the road as
happened here,
did.
As you say, happened
yes.
here. Yeah.
Now, let me just, I just want to emphasize again that Martinez Fuerte, because I don't think we made this point quite clearly in our brief, but in Martinez Fuerte, what was involved was an initial stop at a checkpoint, followed by a referral to a secondary inspection area, based essentially on the officer's suspicion and nothing more than an indication of Mexican ancestry on the part of the passengers of the car. That unquestionably was a seizure of the occupants of the car within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment, and yet the Supreme Court upheld that on the basis of suspicion that they said that was said not to satisfy the requirements for stopping an automobile in Brignone-Ponce. Now, in this case, whatever one may conclude about the suspicion that existed on the part of the officers, I think it was a great deal more than the suspicion that was considered satisfactory in Martinez Fuerte. I would like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Carfondo?
Yes. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I'm Randall Carfanta, representing Sylvia Mendenhall in this case. Initially, I would briefly like to clarify some of the facts on this record. First of all, the agents were looking for basically any citizen to stop. There was no information that any specific heroine was coming into Detroit, nor were they looking for any specific individual. As far as the lack of baggage factor goes, a close reading of the record will show that at the hearing, the agent didn't contend that this was of continuing significance. Rather, the government has continued to argue it in their briefs. As far as the detention in the office, the record contains no written or oral consent. It is absolutely barren of any consent to going to that office. Once Sylvia Mendenhall was in the office, she was asked to take a seat, and then for the first time, the matter of the search was raised. The matter of a strip search was first raised after the consent was allegedly given, and at that point, Sylvia Mendenhall said, "I have to catch my plane. I've got to leave." And she was told that she would be free to leave if she had nothing on her. She kept repeating that, and as the testimony states, then began taking her clothes off, taking her time. As the matter of time that was raised during the prosecutor's argument, the time, as it's reflected on the record, was 5 to 6 minutes until the consent to search was given, but the record does not reflect how long it took to call the female officer, for the female officer to come to the office, and for the actual search itself to begin. Our first contention is that the defendant was arrested within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment when she was in that private, locked DEA office for the purpose of a search of her body. The entire transaction in design and execution was for an investigatory seizure to search Sylvia Mendenhall. A reasonable person in those circumstances could only believe that they were under arrest. She was not told she was free to leave. She was not asked when her plane was leaving, and the setting of the office itself makes that clear. The facts in this case are nothing like any of the stop facts this court has discussed. I believe the farthest this court has gone was in United States v. Brignone-Ponce, and in that case, we're talking about searches that were usually, or stops rather, that were usually a minute in duration and involved a brief visual inspection. There were no exigencies present in this case. Rather, the detention in this case is much more and is really exactly like the detention in Dunaway v. New York, where Dunaway was transported to a police station, placed in an interrogation room, and was not informed that he was free to leave. The only difference here was that Sylvia Mendenhall was also being held incommunicado. We've examined the case law of this court, and we have found three criteria for determining the point of arrest: freedom of movement, the purpose of the detention, and the duration of the detention.
You say that there was no right or power on the part of the officers to ask her questions and ask to see her ticket in the circumstances that existed here?
Your Honor, I believe that under Brown v. Texas, it is clear that when they asked to see her driver's license, required her to answer questions, and then required her to give them her airline ticket, that she had been seized within the Fourth Amendment.
When you say required her?
Yes.
The court has said on a number of occasions that officers may ask questions quite freely of citizens, and that citizens have a right to refuse to answer if they want to.
That's correct, Judge. But I believe that what this court unanimously held in just last term in Brown v. Texas was that when the officers detained appellant for the purpose of requiring him to identify himself, they performed a seizure of his person subject to the requirements of the Fourth Amendment. It seems
Is there a difference between saying, come over here, and I want to ask you a few questions, and simply coming up to a person and saying, what's your name? I mean, is there a separate concept of detention as opposed to simply posing a question to a person?
I think there is, Your Honor. The government has referred to Mr. Lefebvre's treatise, and I know that in his treatise he makes the differentiation between an adversarial contact, which is how I would characterize this case, and seeking information from citizens in general regarding community matters.
Well, how do you, when did it become adversary?
I believe in this case it was adversary from the beginning because...
Is that because of something that was in the officer's mind or something that was in her mind?
I believe that it would be in the officer's mind, in her mind, and also the objective circumstances.
But of course it was in, there was certainly in some tension in her mind because she knew she had heroin. But the officer didn't know that she had heroin.
Well, I think that in terms of looking at the consent issue, that Schneckloth indicates that in determining consent, you have to consider the vulnerable subjective state of mind of the person from whom consent is being sought.
You mean if the person in fact has a packet of heroin on their person or in a package in their possession, then that gives them some special category?
No, I don't believe so. Well, I guess what I'm saying is that I think on this record...
Well, you suggested vulnerability.
Yes. Well,
I suppose a person who's got a packet of heroin does indeed feel somewhat vulnerable.
That's true, Judge. I think the argument I'm trying to make is that here the testimony was that at the point that alleged consent to the detention was given, Sylvia Mendenhall was so nervous she was unable to speak, barely able to put her license and her purse back in her purse. And I think that Schneckloth says that the subjective state of mind of an individual is very important in determining the consent.
Well, Mr. Carfana, supposing the police are investigating a dead body they found on a lawn in front of somebody's house, and they see a neighbor looking over, and the policeman simply calls over the neighbor and says, do you know anything about this? Is that a detention or arrest or Terry stop?
No, I don't believe it is.
Suppose the neighbor comes over to the scene that Mr. Justice Rehnquist has described, and then the police officer says, will you please just wait here for a few minutes? I want to ask you some questions. Arrest? Detention?
Probably not arrest or detention, but...
Well, suppose then the person began to go away and the officer said, I want you to stay here. There's been a homicide, and I want you to stay here as a material witness. Arrest?
Probably.
Probably arrested, then.
As I was discussing in Dunaway v. New York, the court held that freedom of movement is a controlling factor in determining the point of arrest. Here, I believe the objective circumstances, the fact that Sylvia Mendenhall was not told she was free to go, and the fact that, in fact, she was not free to go, indicate satisfaction of that factor. Secondly, you look to the purpose of the detention. Here, the purpose of the detention was not to maintain the status quo. It was not for identification purposes. The officer testified that on the concourse, he was satisfied that this person was Sylvia Mendenhall. Rather, the only purpose in going to that office was to search for narcotics. And Cibarron v. New York and Ibarra v. Illinois indicate that when the purpose is to search for narcotics, probable cause is required because that situation is an arrest. And finally, the length of the detention. United States v. Brignone-Ponce says the detention must be brief. In that case, the detentions were ordinarily about a minute. Here, Sylvia Mendenhall was not told she was free to leave. In their Court of Appeals pleadings, the government has indicated that if a person refuses consent in the DEA office, the DEA then seeks a search warrant. In the companion case, on the embanked hearing in this case, the officer testified, well, then we told Mr. Camacho that it would take us an hour or 3 or 4 hours to obtain the search warrant, if we can. No time was ever specified in this case. It was a potentially indefinite detention. I think the law of this court is clear that once Sylvia Mendenhall was in that interrogation office, the situation was an arrest. And further, I think common sense indicates that this is an arrest situation. There was no consent to that detention. As I've indicated, the record was barren of any verbal or written consent to that detention. Sylvia Mendenhall was not told she had any choice about going to that office.
Well, the district court found that there was consent, that she voluntarily went to the office, and that finding was in no way disturbed by the Court of Appeals, as I've just read their opinion.
Well, I would answer that.
Am I mistaken about that?
I would say on the second point, you are mistaken in the sense that they said there was no consent.
To the search.
You're right, Judge. Your Honor.
So but, am I mistaken?
No, you're not. What I would indicate, though, is that this record is totally barren of anything indicating consent to the detention. Therefore, the finding of the district court is easily, clearly erroneous. There is nothing on this record indicating that. Further, the burden is on the prosecution. There's no reason to think that she would have chosen this incommunicado detention. She was extremely nervous. All these factors militate against a free and voluntary consent, but most importantly, there is nothing on this record stating any consent to that detention.
Suppose as you're leaving the courtroom today, one of the officers approaches you and says, Mr. Rodak, the clerk of the court, would like to see you for a few minutes. What do you think your situation is? Are you detained? Are you arrested? Or what?
No, I don't think anything.
If you go there to his office and the secretary says, well, Mr. Rodak's on the telephone, will you sit down and you wait for 5 minutes? Are you detained?
I don't think this is the kind of adversarial confrontation between a police officer and citizens.
Is that perhaps partly because you know that you have no heroin on you and no contraband of any kind?
That question is like, when did you stop beating your wife?
Well, but you not at all, not at all. You have emphasized the vulnerability of a witness. You would go very freely because you don't feel very vulnerable about anything, do you, in this setting?
On the other hand, if one of the DEA agents, some of whom I know, came up to me and said, we want you to go into this little room off the corridor here away from the courtroom, and we're going to have a little talk with you about some of the things you said, I might be very apprehensive. But if it was going to Mr. Rodak's office, I don't think this is the kind of adversarial confrontation between police officer and citizen that the commentators in the cases envision.
Would you consider it adversary or adversarial if the particular citizen has no contraband, no drugs, no firearms?
I think that's the entire point of the defense contention in this case, is that on the kinds of flimsy factors this person was stopped and then arrested, it could apply to the search of anyone, anywhere, on just basically nothing. I think that's the point. That the Fourth Amendment doesn't allow these kinds of wholesale intrusions.
Do you think the Court of Appeals set aside or disturbed the finding of consent to the search in the drug office?
I definitely do.
By direct statement or by inference?
I believe what the Court of Appeals said was that there was no consent to the search in this case within the meaning of United States v. McCallum. Just one more point on the consent to the detention, and that is that Bumper v. North Carolina also makes it very clear that mere acquiescence in the face of authority is not the kind of free and voluntary consent that is required. Further, or secondly, we contend that the stop, there was no reasonable suspicion for the stop when all the agents knew at the point of the stop was that Sylvia Mendenhall had flown from Los Angeles to Detroit, was the last person off the airplane, and looked nervous to the agents. Now, the government has argued...
And was traveling under an assumed name.
Well, I was speaking of the point of the initial stop, Your Honor. The government has additionally argued two factors, transfer of airline plans and lack of baggage. Those both we've shown evaporated prior to the stop in this case. Great emphasis has been placed in these cases, these airport profile cases, on the experience of the agents. But I think that that experience is a two-way street, that when the agents see something that negates suspicion, that should stop them from detaining a citizen. Here, the agents proceeded to detain the citizen, even though there was no transfer of airlines factor in this case. The government has argued that these experienced agents are familiar with all the airline schedules. Well, in this case, the agent testified on this record that he was not familiar with the relevant airline schedules. Further, there is no showing on this record that would support his conclusion that she was changing airlines. This experienced agent should have known that when she went to that Eastern counter and they said all you need to get on that plane is a boarding pass, that she was already scheduled on that flight. Further, had he known the airline schedule or taken a moment to check it, he would have found that there was no American flight from Detroit to Pittsburgh. This transfer of airlines factor has appeared in no other case. In fact, in other arrests, in reported opinions that occurred at Detroit Metropolitan Airport, using direct flights was the factors in those cases.
Second, what if in this case she had been booked from Los Angeles to Minneapolis, she immediately arrives in Minneapolis, goes to the counter of a airline that has a flight from Minneapolis to New York and switches her ticket, or perhaps buys a ticket from Minneapolis to New York. And the agent says, that's unusual because you could have easily booked directly out of Los Angeles to New York without going to Minneapolis. Is that a permissible profile factor to consider?
Well, Judge, or Your Honor, I believe that you have to consider everything that the agent actually knew. And in our brief, we contend that the profile itself does not arise to reasonable suspicion, and none of the courts of appeals have held it has.
You think nothing short of probable cause, then, is sufficient to even warrant further interrogation?
No, I believe that when there is reasonable suspicion, and there are Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals and Second Circuit Court of Appeals cases that have found reasonable suspicion, that then an investigatory stop on reasonable suspicion is proper.
But you don't think that any rather strange conduct in airline routing and sudden changes of destinations are permissible factors in a profile?
Oh, yes, I do, because I think that it's common law that such things as flight can be considered in arrest situations. And so I think that all factors can be considered. I think that's a very elusive factor, but certainly all factors ought to be considered. As I indicated, the lack of baggage factor also evaporated prior to the stop in this case. The agent didn't even contend it was of continuing significance to him. Rather, the government has continued to argue it. At any rate, once he knew she was going on to Pittsburgh, through common sense or through the airline tariff regulations, he should have realized that she would have no baggage with her. The proper police practice in this case, I believe, would have been to continue the surveillance, as has been done in a number of Second Circuit cases, such as United States v. Oates. They knew she wasn't leaving the airport. They could have called ahead to Pittsburgh if they wanted to watch her, instead of proceeding to detain a citizen. Looking quickly at the factors they did know, the flight from Los Angeles to Detroit, it seems that in these profile cases, the government has virtually characterized almost every city as being a source or a place you go through or
yes,
a destination.
But if you're right, what could have been done in Pittsburgh? If there was no probable cause, there's no probable cause, either in Detroit or Pittsburgh.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I would use the example of United States v. Oates, when they got to Pittsburgh, a bulge mysteriously appeared. They talked with a known narcotics dealer. The traveling companion was a known narcotics addict.
Yes, but in this case, you suggested, well, it's very easy. The government just could have wired ahead or telephoned ahead to Pittsburgh. But if you're correct, if there's no probable cause, there's no probable cause. If this seizure and search violated the constitutional rights of your client in Detroit, a seizure and search would equally have violated those rights in Pittsburgh, would it not?
Well, that's correct, Judge. What I'm indicating is that if they would have continued their investigation, perhaps something else would have turned up.
Well, you mean, for example, if they got to Pittsburgh, they might have telephoned Pittsburgh and said, watch this woman when she gets off. If, one, she's last to leave the plane, and, two, she looks nervous, and, three, she doesn't, in fact, have any luggage to pick up, then stop her and arrest her. Something like that?
No, Your Honor.
Well, what would be the additional factors that you suggest might supplement what Mr. Justice Stewart just put to you? You said some other factors might show up.
I guess I'm indicating that since those are the same factors we have in Detroit, and since I don't feel that those factors have very much value, that those factors occurring twice would not have very much value.
Well, what if you take the three that I've just mentioned? Suppose they did occur. The agent found in Pittsburgh she was last to leave the plane, as she had been before, and that she did not have any luggage. In fact, even though that's quite a long trip to be without luggage, and third, she acted in a very nervous manner in the same way the telephone call had described her conduct previously. You'd think those might finally reach a point where it would cross over the line?
Not to reasonable suspicion, no, I don't.
Well, then what was the point of your suggestion that they wait until they get to Pittsburgh?
The point of my suggestion was that very often, in continuing an investigation, additional factors of weight do turn up, and sometimes they don't, and then you cannot proceed to detain a citizen.
Well, you said one of them would be that if, on arrival in Pittsburgh, she was met by a person known to the Pittsburgh agent as a drug dealer. Of course, there you're so far over the line, you're leaving no room for any analysis at all, are you?
I don't believe that's true. I think that in looking at the case law, the Sixth Circuit and the Second Circuit have both held that mysterious bulges, in one case, a person was seen walking with an odd gait, with an odd bulge in the crotch area, indicating that there was something concealed there. I think those kinds of factors can begin to create reasonable suspicion. I don't think these totally innocuous characteristics, when there is no tie-in with criminal activity, can present justification for stopping a citizen. As to the nervousness factor, it's difficult to hypothesize a more common characteristic to airline passengers than nervousness.
When they're getting on or when they're getting off?
Well, I would, as far as I go personally, I would say that would be from the time I leave home till the time I arrive at my destination away from the airport. The flaw in the government's case here, and I believe it's similar to Brown v. Texas, is that there is no tie-in with criminal activity. In Spinelli v. United States, Mr. Justice White wrote in concurrence, no one would suggest that just anyone getting off the 10:30 train dressed as Draper was, with a brisk walk and carrying a zipper bag, should be arrested for carrying narcotics. Query whether Mr. Justice White would have felt differently had Draper been last off the train. Other circuits have reviewed circumstances very similar to this case. We cited United States v. Ballard, a Fifth Circuit case in our brief at pages 37 and 38, and I recently last week sent a recent Second Circuit opinion, United States v. Buenaventura, and they reached the same obvious result. It just is not sufficient cause for stopping a citizen. The drug courier profile itself is an amorphous, unwritten conglomeration of characteristics of persons which the government characterizes as constantly changing. Some courts have commented that the profile seems to change itself to fit the facts of each case. In fact, if you look at the characteristics we have listed in our footnotes, you would see there'd be a rare airline passenger that would not fit several of these characteristics. And this is particularly true given the agent's ability to find satisfaction of a profile factor regardless of the facts. There is no national profile, there is no Detroit Metropolitan Airport profile, and there is no Agent Anderson profile. The courts of appeals have refused to uphold the stops of citizens based on this profile because there's a recognition that the power to do so would allow basic searches of citizens anywhere without cause. I would like, and further, as far as any discretion reducing aspect of the profile, what the profile really is a screen for the abuse of government power because the agents pick and choose among the many that it describes. Finally, and I see my time is short, that the consent to the search in this case was not freely and voluntarily given. Schneckloth speaks of a familiar territory case where all was very congenial. The defendant was with five or six friends. They said interrogation in the remote station house is inapposite. Here, that's exactly the setting we have. Sylvia Mendenhall was in that setting. She was quite shaken. She was not told she was free to leave. She was not told she had any choice about the detention. The first time anything about a search was mentioned was when she was inside that room. The first time anything about a strip search was mentioned was after the alleged consent was given. And then she revoked the consent by saying, well, I have a plane to catch. And she was told, well, if you don't have anything on you, you don't have anything to worry about. She kept saying, well, I have a plane to catch, as she slowly began taking her clothing off. And finally, we would contend that the alleged consent here was also the product of an arrest without probable cause and a stop without reasonable suspicion, and that taint was not removed within the means.
Does the record show how much of a layover there was between the two flights?
No, it does not.
Well, then we don't know whether she was under pressure for time or not, do we?
We do not. It's clear that for a consent, the burden is on the prosecution to show that the consent was freely and voluntarily given. Like Brown v. Illinois, and New York v. Dunaway here, there was a quality of purposefulness and an expedition for evidence undertaken in the hope that something would turn up. We contend that the methodology here was to cause, and this has been characterized by Eastern District of Michigan Court, to cause surprise, fright, and confusion. I think the law of this court is clear on each of these points. Moreover, I think common sense supports our contentions. I think the contentions of the government would be basically to do away with the case-by-case approach in Fourth Amendment cases, and this our Constitution does not allow.
Mr. Carapaca, before you sit down, you take the position that had she refused, that the record shows that if she had refused to go to the office, that the officers would have required her to go, that they had intended to detain her. Do you have any position on what the record indicates would have happened if, after the female officer had come into the room and told her to take her clothes off, that if she had refused to do that, what would have happened? You do say that she didn't realize until that happened that she was going to be
going to be
a strip search. Does the record tell us what her what she would have done or what would have happened if she'd refused to take that additional step.
Well, I believe defense counsel cross-examined both the agent and the female officer as to each point. Was she free to go at the point of the stop? Was she free to go at the point of the arrest? Was she free to go at the point of the consent? And at each point, the answer was no. I would like to clarify one point of my position that you just mentioned in your question, and that was, I'm not sure I can remember, but our position on the consent to the detention is that the record is barren of any consent, and therefore the district court was clearly erroneous.
Well, there is testimony on page 12 of the appendix by the officer that before she went to the office, she gave some kind of consent, and I thought it read consent to the search of the purse and the person. I think that's what he, am I wrong on that?
Well, what it says here is I asked her if she would accompany myself and Agent Myhills to our office, which was very nearby. But there's no indication that she was told she had any choice. There's no indication of any written or oral consent. And the record does show that she was so nervous at that point that she could hardly speak nor return her items of identification to her purse.
Suppose disagreed with you and with the Court of Appeals, I take it, that with respect to probable cause. Suppose we thought there was probable cause to arrest in the office. What would your argument be then?
Well, I suppose my argument at that point would be that if there were no exigencies, a search warrant should have been sought.
Well, there's probable cause to arrest. And you claim there was an arrest. You argue consistently all through that there was an arrest.
That's correct. Judge.
Well, what about, you don't need a warrant to search incident to arrest, do you?
No, you
don't. You don't need a warrant to search and to arrest on probable cause public place.
No.
So what would be your argument if we disagreed with you on probable cause? The district court found probable cause, didn't it?
The district court actually, and I'm glad you gave me a chance to clarify this, although I think the district court was wrong. The district court said that at the point they first reached the office, there was no probable cause. Where the district court found probable cause was after they went through her purse. That is where the district court found probable cause. And although I disagree with that, the district court specifically said no probable cause when they first got to the office.
But there was but they found consent to search the purse.
That's correct.
At what point did the officers find out that she had three different names, that is, two in addition to her true name?
That point was on the concourse. No, I'm sorry. The fact that the ticket was in another name was found out on the concourse. Was there a third name? The third name was found after they went through her purse.
Well, you still haven't answered my question. Suppose we find that the officers, contrary to your position, the officers validly acquired probable cause at some point prior to the search, prior to the strip search. What would you have? Say you've lost your case or not, or would you have some other argument?
Well, I guess I would say at that point that that it would be a search incident to arrest.
That sounds like it's valid.
At the point that they had the consent to search her purse, I would contend that that would be a product, a tainted product of the illegal stop.
You say you would argue it would be a
poison fruit.
That it was a product of a illegal arrest, right.
Or an illegal stop.
Yeah. Thank you.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Fry?
Yes, I have a couple of minor points and one I think of fairly major importance that I hope to be able to talk about. The first point is on the question of where she was going, whether she was going on American Airlines. You're being asked to take judicial notice of facts for the first time in the Supreme Court. I think there is a lot of
difficulty with doing that in a case where respondent's own lawyer in the district court was not aware of this supposedly obvious fact. Indeed, everybody conceded in the district court that she was changing her flight. The whole case was argued on that basis. There was no exploration on cross-examination. And the Fourth Amendment does not require that he be right in his belief that she was changing flights, but only that he have some basis that would add to his suspicion. Now, with regard to Brown against Texas, it has absolutely no bearing on this case, because in Brown against Texas, Brown was convicted of failing to give his identification after having been lawfully stopped. It would have availed the state of Texas nothing to argue that he was not stopped in that case, since that would have been a confession of error. And the court makes quite clear in its opinion that since the conviction can be sustained only if he was lawfully stopped, the question is whether the facts known justified a stop. There was no occasion in Brown to discuss whether the initial encounter was a stop.
Well, Mr. Fry, I take it from what, on your direct argument, on your initial argument, that you weren't taking any position on whether there was or not was not probable cause to arrest. I take it then, are we to judge the case on the assumption that there never was probable cause to arrest prior to the search?
Well, that raises the problem of what we've presented to the court in our petition for certiorari and whether you are free. I mean, the district court did find that there was probable cause to arrest and search.
Do you defend that?
Purse was.
Do you defend that or not?
Well, we haven't asked for review on that ground, but I would defend that. I think.
Well, the Court of Appeals thought there wasn't probable cause.
I understand that.
So we judge the case on the assumption that the officers never validly acquired probable cause to arrest.
I think you would certainly be well within propriety to do so, since mm-hmm. we didn't challenge that conclusion at the district court. Now, let me get to the critical point in this case, which is the question of whether there was a flimsy basis for the stop, assuming that the court determines that this was a Fourth Amendment seizure of her person. There is a wide gulf between respondents' position and ours. And I think respondents' position is that you must have virtually probable cause in order to have a stop on founded suspicion. And his reference to Draper was extremely revealing because, of course, the question in Draper was probable cause and not founded suspicion. Now, in the present case, Agent Anderson had 10 years of experience in drug enforcement and many months stationed at the Detroit airport. Now, during this period, he received specialized training, and he'd watched tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of passengers, and participated in a substantial number of drug arrests. Now, when he saw a respondent deplane and scanned nervously as though looking for surveillance, it does not strain credulity to accept that Agent Anderson knew the difference between the nervousness of people who are scared of flying, worried about missing a connection.
Can you tell us how often he was wrong over the last 10 years?
The record does not tell you.
Be right this time, but we don't know whether maybe 1 out of 10 or 9 out of 10.
But what we are talking about, the record does not indicate, although there is an opinion which does in the Garcia case in the Eastern District of New York, which indicates that very few people are stopped. In that particular case, they had watched 9 flights come in during the day before they approached a single person and in that case it was, I think, quite clearly a stop. We are not talking about picking large numbers of people out. We are not talking about invidious selection of people.
You're not, but if I understood your answer to Mr. Justice White, your position, if sustained, in this case, would allow you to make virtually random stops if you could get the kind of sequence of consents you got here.
The first position that this is not a seizure within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment would allow a police officer, without violating the Fourth Amendment, to approach somebody and ask a question. That's a clear consent all the way along.
The sequence of events ends up in an office upstairs in the airport with the suspect taking his clothes off.
The Fourth Amendment would be implicated at that point, at the point of the search.
But not violated on these.
I think quite clearly not violated, yes.
But the stops, Mr. Solicitor General,
as I understand your argument, would not be random stops if all of these facts existed.
We are not talking, I've now moved to the argument about whether there is founded suspicion if this is a stop. And there we are saying the Fourth Amendment does apply, and I am saying that we are having very limited intrusion and the experience of the agents.
But this issue, which you now describe as critical, we need address only if we are not persuaded on the consent sequence.
That's right.
If there was consent all along the line, we don't have to decide that.
No, you would have to decide it. You have to decide with respect to the initial encounter in the airport concourse whether, A, it was not a Fourth Amendment seizure, or, B, if it was, it was lawful, because otherwise what ensued following that encounter was arguably a fruit of the initial illegality. So the consents, we are only relying on the consent in the sense that her voluntary cooperation and show at this stage and showing her ticket and showing her identification.
That's a combination of things. We have you, of course, argue in part that the initial encounter was nothing more than asking a bystander a question, in effect. If we accepted that point and that everything after that was consensual, then we wouldn't have to reach
You would not have to reach the question whether there was founded suspicion or probable cause at any point. That's correct.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in 79.